He gets out that sheet of paper, and he reads to them what my thinking was 4 or 5 years prior to that time when I was sitting there in the office. Now, we know we call that piece of paper a will. It's not by accident. Will, thinking, mind are all synonymous. I'm making a decision to turn my will, my thinking apparatus, over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him. Also, I'm making a decision to turn my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand Him. Now, what is my life? Well, my life is nothing more than my actions. What I am, as of right now, this moment, sitting behind this table, is the sum accumulative action of all, or some accumulating actions that I've taken throughout my entire lifetime has made me just exactly what I am today. All action is born in thought.
Say that again, please.
All action is born in thought. Sometimes we act so rapidly, we think we do that automatically, but we don't. I can't even reach out and pick up this cup of water unless my mind tells my body to do so. So if all action is born in thought, then apparently my life is determined by how I think. If my thinking is okay, chances are my actions will be okay, and chances are my life's going to be okay too. But if my thinking is lousy, then chances are my actions are going to be lousy, and certainly my life's going to become lousy also. It's not by accident that the step says will and life. A lot of people read it backwards. They read life and will. No, it's will and life. Now, I shall never forget when I got to step 3. And I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I'm going to be able to take step 3. And he said, why? I said, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I have no idea what He would have me be. And He might want me to be a missionary. And He may want to send me to China. And I said, I sure as hell don't want to go to China. And he just laughed. And he said, well, let's look at it this way. He said, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of an idiot, would it? He said, let's look back in your lifetime, Charlie. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. You've always done exactly what you wanted to do, and to hell with the rest of them. Is that right? And I said, yeah, it is. He said, the end result is that your life became an absolute living hell. And he said, just as importantly, those around you who care for you, their life became an absolute living hell too. He said, now just think, if God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And he said, if your thinking becomes better, then chances are your actions are going to become better. And he said, if your actions become better, then chances are your life's going to become better also. And he said, just as importantly, the lives of those around you that care for you, they will probably become better too. But he said, left on your own resources, you absolutely do not stand a chance. He said, left on self-will, you'll remain restless, irritable, and discontented. You'll remain filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And he said, under those conditions, sooner or later, you're going to start thinking about drinking. Next thing you know, you'll become insane again. And you'll believe it's okay to drink, and you'll end up drunk all over again. He stepped back about 3 feet, stuck his bony old finger right in the middle of my chest. He said, now it's up to you to make the decision. He said, I wish I could make it for you, but I can't. This is one you'll have to do yourself. And he got through to me in such a manner that he convinced me there's no way that I'm going to have any decent life in the future if I don't do something about this self-will thing. Joe?
You know, we all said we balk at every step. Surely we're threatened here, and I think all of us are feeling comfortable with this. I didn't understand it, but I know when I got here, I didn't like the way it sounded. I didn't want to turn my life over. It didn't say it, but I assumed it said, turn my life over to God. And I wasn't about to do that, because I knew what God was going to do in my life. I figured if I turned my life over to God, He's going to put me in the Salvation Army band. That was my fear. I got to see myself standing out there in the corner of the little horn, Rock of Asia, you know.
I keep telling him they don't play little horns, they play big horns in the Salvation Army band.
Well, I was telling him, you know, since then, every year I always watch the Salvation Army band. I've been 40 years now, almost now, but I always watch them every Christmas when I see them, wherever I see them at. And it's amazing why I had that fear, because I had never seen a black guy in the Salvation Army.
They don't like that kind of music, do they, Joe?
Ain't our kind of music, in the first place. We have all these fears. But, you know, we have to look at, look at self. You know, we are the only animal on the face of this earth that has will and intelligence in the form that we have. God gave us, made us. He created all the other animals, all the other plants, all the other living things. And He said, I'm not going to give y'all self-will. I'm going to direct y'all. Right? He directs all the other plants. He directs all the other animals. He controls all of them. Don't get in trouble either, dude. Never seen a tree hit a car. And these things I direct, also said, since I direct them, I will care for them. I care for what I direct. But He wasn't satisfied. He said He wanted something else in this world. He wanted a higher form of life. He wanted something else in His image. I didn't mean to look like Him physically. He wanted something else with will. Something else with the ability to direct. Something else with intelligence. So He said, He created we humans and He gave us self-will. We're the only animal on the face of this earth that has it. There are two forms of will on the face of this earth. There's God's will and human will. And we're going to learn later, as it says in 12, this valuable thing is good to have. It's very necessary. It sets us apart, makes us different than other things, but it causes us problems. In the beginning, I like to hear a little story about being in the garden, and Adam and Eve was in a nice, quiet place. Called it Serenity Park. Had a meeting every night. Everything went on just fine. They were satisfied. God was directing the little park and everything in it, and this and that. When they got here, God was directing everything. So they went along with the program. God let God direct their lives. And a little snake come along one day and saw Eve. He said, Eve, I need to talk to you, honey. And she said, what do you want? She said, you know you got self-will. He said, no, what is that? He said, child, shoot. You don't have to do what he said. I do, because I'm a snake. But you and Adam got self-will. Y'all can do what the hell y'all want to do. She said, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, child. So she went and told Adam, Adam, you know we got self-will. Adam probably said, what is that? She ran it down to him real good, and he said, I believe I'll use it. And he decided to eat the apple.
Made a decision.
The first one he ever made. And it was a bad one. He didn't know that first one he ever made. God saw the apple gone, and he said, uh-oh, they gone to thinking. They making a decision. And he said, in this garden, I direct this garden. I control, I take care of it, I direct it. And that which I direct, I take care of. Now, if you're going to direct yourself, you got to leave here. And the human race, they were put out of the garden. And they were also told at that time, you got to leave, but you can come back on one condition. You can come back under my care under one condition. They said, what is that? You give me back self. And then I'll direct your life. That's the only way you can come back. But that's the deal we got. Every human being in the world is faced with that. Sometime every human being in the world in his lifetime is faced with that decision. It's an age-old factor that all humans are going to face that. So it's this. We have to get, the Oxford Group people said, we make a decision to get back to God. Well, he so freely gave us in our creation self-will.
I think it's very important that we remember the covenant that God made with human beings when he put Adam and Eve out. He said, if you're going to operate on self-will, and I'll no longer take care of you, you'll have to take care of yourself, you'll have to provide for yourself, I'll not do that any longer. But then as they started out of the garden, he stopped. And he said, wait just a minute, I'm going to make a deal with you. He said, I love you enough that I'll let you stay out there on self-will until you absolutely destroy yourself. He said, I'll never take it back from you. If you want to come back in the garden and you want me to take care of you, then you'll have to give self-will back to me. I'll never, never take it away from you. And I think that's what we need to remember today. That in this covenant with God, he's going to let us do whatever we want to do. He's going to let us exercise self-will all we want to. And he loves us enough that he will let us destroy ourselves on self-will. And God knows we alcoholics almost did it completely too. He'll never take it back. We will have to freely give it back. You know, it's been said that Adam was probably alcoholic too. Because when God saw that the apple was gone, he said, Adam, where's the apple? And Adam said, well, God, we ate it. And God said, you ate it. I told you you couldn't do that. Why did you eat that apple? And Adam spun around and pointed at Eve and said, she made me do it. And we've been saying it ever since, too.
A covenant means promise. They made a promise.
Eve was probably the world's first compulsive overeater, too. And between the two, he flipped us out of the garden. So now then, the question becomes, how do we get back there? How do we get back in God's grace? How do we go about the turning of our will and our lives back to the care and direction of God as we understand Him, Joe?
It wasn't in the apple in the tree that caused all the problem. It was the pear on the ground. Oh, isn't that terrible? Of course, the old snake, he didn't have a leg to stand on, you know. Okay, this is how it works. You know, I said the other day, yesterday, I said we talk about precisely, specifically, with clear-cut directions. Well, Bill is going to start giving us some clear-cut directions. Sometimes they're very short and very sweet, but we have to learn to read again. At least I did. I had to realize what a question mark meant. It meant to stop and wonder what he just said. Periods mean to stop. A new thought is coming. Comma means to pause. And so Bill understood that very well. And sometimes, and in my case, I just jumped over those things and went right on and looking for a harder way to do it, you see. But let's look at the clear-cut directions that Bill gave us. And the very next statement said, the first requirement. See, he's going to tell us what to do first. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. If only people would mind me. I know things would be better if they would just mind me. But there's only one thing wrong with that. Is everybody's got a self-will. That's the problem with the self-will. Everybody's got one. And my wife's will for her is one thing. My will for her is another. And she don't do my will for her. She does her will for her. As Joe talked about driving the car this morning. And that's the problem with it. So the first requirement is we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. Now, 10 or 12, 13 years after Bill wrote the big book, through many, many years of experience and consultation with some of the best minds in the world about what makes alcoholics tick, Bill came up with some basic instincts of life. And those words that we're going to talk about now, these basic instincts of life, these are words right out of the big book. These are not new words. But we're going to use those basic instincts of life, or at least those words and the understanding of those words, in the third column when we get around to doing our inventory. And it would be nice if we understood a little bit about what those basic instincts are and had a little bit of working knowledge of those words. I needed that information. Mm-hmm. And Bill wrote this 12 and 12, some 13 years after he wrote the big book, and the area of the four steps. In the first three or four pages, he talks about the basic instincts of life. And I learned more about human nature and what makes me tick from those three or four pages than I've ever known before. Mm-hmm. And when I sponsor people today, I get to this point, I ask them to go to the 12 and 12, the first three or four pages, and to get an understanding of these basic instincts of life and the words in which we're going to be talking about so they can better do the fourth step.
For a long, long time, in reading this information at the bottom of page 60, into 61, up into 62, where he talks about the actor that wants to run the whole show, forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, etc. I would read that information, but I really, really didn't have any idea what he was talking about and how that really tied back in with step three itself. Until I found this information that Joe's talking about in the 12 and 12. Now, we're not going to look into the 12 and 12. We're not going to try to go through it. That's what somebody else is doing this weekend, Willie and John. But there's some information in there that I think if we could really, really understand it and absorb it, then it's going to make it much, much easier to understand step three and to be able to see what we're supposed to do in step three in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's always been a lot of question as to why Bill even wrote the 12 and 12 in the first place. Probably two or three reasons behind the fact that he did so. Number one, Bill had had so much difficulty in getting the fellowship to accept the traditions that I think he felt if I could put the two together, something regarding the steps and the traditions in the same book, that the traditions themselves would become more acceptable to the fellowship. That's one reason. But I think the real reason he wrote it is this. We got to face the fact that in 1939, 37, 38, 39, when Bill was writing the big book, Bill was not a great spiritual giant. Bill was not a great student of human nature. Bill was a night school lawyer, a New York City stock speculator. Yet he was able to write one of the most spiritual books dealing with human nature that the world's ever seen. He did the absolute best that he could in 1939. Now, I think 13 years later, after having worked with some of the greatest spiritual minds in the world, after having dealt with many, many, many alcoholics, I think Bill understood more about the steps in 1950, 51, and 52 than he did back in 1939. I think he felt he had some additional information that he could give us regarding the steps that would make it easier to work the steps according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We do not believe that the 12 and 12 was meant to replace the Big Book. You really can't work the steps out of the 12 and 12 because there's no directions in there telling you how to do that. And that may be one of the reasons a lot of people love it also, because they can get in there and dance around and philosophize and talk and talk, and they're never really called upon to do anything. The only piece of literature that we have that tells us how to work the steps is the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill recognizes that when he tells us in the very beginning of the 12 and 12 that it's there to give us additional information, a series of essays on the steps, so we can better work them according to the Big Book. He said that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was a basic text for AA, always has been, always will be. But there's some information in that 12 and 12 that I think is absolute marvelous information. And I'm like Joe, on the first three or four pages of step four in the 12 and 12, I learn more about what makes me tick, what makes me think the way I think, what makes me act the way I act. I learned more in four pages of that book than I'd learned of 40 years of living before I came to AA. And he talks there about the basic instincts of life, which create self itself. And if we can see those basic instincts and see how they create self, then we can really begin to understand why we need to get rid of self-will. It also helps us in step three, and it also sets us up for step four. Because he uses the terminology of these basic instincts of life in the Big Book in step four, but he didn't explain them, and I don't think he could explain them at that time. But he certainly did 13 years later in the 12 and 12. There he talks about these three basic instincts of life. And he says, all human beings are born with these three basic instincts of life, that they are absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. Therefore, they must be good things. He broke it down into three things. He talked about the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. And under the social instinct, he said, all human beings are born with the desire to be liked, to be accepted, to be recognized by other human beings. He said if we didn't have that desire, if we cared nothing at all about what our fellow human beings thought of us, there would be no society on earth, period. That if we cared nothing about other human beings and what they thought of us, the world would go into dog-eat-dog situation, complete anarchy would reign, and under those conditions, the human race would simply fail to survive. So these desires that you and I have, to be liked, to be accepted, to be recognized by other people, they are a God-given thing, they are a good thing, they are necessary for our survival. He used several terms under that. He talked about companionship. Companionship is nothing more than wanting to belong or to be accepted by other people. How many of us, as we were kids growing up, always felt like we were on the outside of the crowd looking in, wanted to be a part of and knew we could not be, desperately wanted that recognition and acceptance from other human beings? He used the term prestige. Now, prestige is nothing more than wanting to be recognized or to be accepted as the leader of the group. And the world needs leaders. Somebody's got to make decisions. I guess even back in the old caveman days, somebody had to say, John, get behind that tree with your spear. Mary Bell, You get over behind that bush with your club. And Don and I are going to run this sucker through here, and we're going to jump him, and we're going to have something to eat. Somebody has to do that.
Okay.
Now, most people will take either one of two routes. Either let me be a part of, or let me be the leader of. In either case, it's going to be based upon what they think of us. If they like us and accept us and respect us, we can become those things. If they don't and they reject us, then we feel like we're on the outside of the crowd looking in. He talked about self-esteem. Self-esteem is what we think of ourselves. And that's usually high or low, based upon what other people think of us or what we think other people think of us. If they seem to like us and accept us, we feel pretty good toward ourselves. If they reject us, or we think they reject us, then we feel pretty lousy toward ourselves. Pride. Oh, I'm glad I got in the habit of going to the dictionary. I used to think pride is something that you ought to have. When I was a young fella growing up, all I ever wanted to be was a man who walked tall with pride and a little bit sideways, just like John Wayne did. That's all I ever wanted to be. Until I looked it up in a dictionary, and the dictionary defines pride as an excessive and unjustified opinion of oneself. Hmm. We either think too well of ourselves, we think too little of ourselves. In either case, it's not true. Personal relationships is our relations with other human beings and the world around us. Ambitions are our plans for the future to gain power, recognition, acceptance, and so forth. All things come from that social instinct which is God-given. Now, if I want to be liked and accepted and respected by the world and everybody in it, then the first thing I've got to do is decide, well, what is it that I need to do to be liked and accepted and respected? And the world teaches us those things as we grow up. And we listen to and we watch other people. And based upon what we think they want from us, then we're like the actor that wants to run the whole show. We then write a little script in our mind as to what we need to become. And we set the goal in order to become those things that we think we need to be in the future. Now, that'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world is to have a good education. Another part of the world is to be a large landowner. Another part of the world, it may be to have a large family. Another part of the world, it may be to be a good businessman. It'll vary in different parts of the world. And based upon what we're taught, we set our goals and we begin to work toward those goals. Now, if you're going to reach the goals you set for yourself, you can't be just a bum and sit on your duff and do nothing and reach the goals. At the same token, we're probably going to have to make some sacrifices. You know, there are some things that I would like to do as a human being that are very exciting and very pleasurable. But if I do those things and you catch me at it, you're not going to like me at all. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to reach the goal. Nor make the sacrifices necessary to be accepted unless we got a reward for doing so. And the great reward we get is that great feeling at the moment of successful completion of the goal. And they pat us on the back and they say, "Ah, Joe, you're a fine fella. You're doing a great job. You're a smart man." My God, we get one of those feelings which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. But the only thing wrong with it, though, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, we no sooner reach the goal, we get the recognition, we get the power, we get the acceptance, and we look around, we say, well, is this all there is to it? And we set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we reach the goal and we get the recognition and the power and et cetera, and my God, it feels great, but it doesn't last very long, so we set another goal. And are not giving it to us quite as fast as we think they ought to. We're not getting it the way we think we should, so what do? Well, we start taking shortcuts. We start doing a little lying, a little conning, a little manipulating, a little stepping on other people's toes and climbing on their backs in order to get our what we think we need, and the instant we do that, we create pain and suffering for others. This seems to create within us an insatiable desire for more and more power, more and more recognition, more and more acceptance, and in trying to get it more fast or rapidly, we end up creating pain and suffering for other people. And the instant we do that, they retaliate against us, and then they create pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. He talked about the security instinct. And he said all human beings are born with the desire to be secure in the future. And he said if we didn't have that desire, we wouldn't provide the food, the clothing, the shelter, the things that we're going to need in the future. Next winter season, we would freeze to death. The next drought season, we would starve to death. Now, I know in AA, we try to live one day at a time. But I also know that everybody in this room has got an insurance policy. And the insurance policy is to protect ourselves in the future. That's a basic, God-given thing, and it's normal. Now, if I want to be secure in the future, once again, I'm going to have to decide, well, what is it I need in order to be secure in the future? And once again, society teaches us these things. As we grow up, we listen to others, we watch what they do, and we start determining what we need in order to be secure in the future. It'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world is $4. Another part of the world is $4,000. Another part of the world is $4 million. Another part of the world, it's 192 coconuts. Whatever it is that they use to measure, trade, and barter with. And based upon what we're taught, we set our goals. And we start working toward that goal. Now, if you're going to be secure in the future, you can't just sit on your duff and have nothing and be secure in the future. By the same token, we're going to have to make sacrifices. We can't blow everything we've got today if we want to be secure in the future. We're going to have to work, we're going to have to save, we're going to have to invest, and etc. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to make the sacrifices necessary to be secure in the future if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. My God, how many of us have done it? We started out for a new bicycle. We started out for a new dress. We started out for a new pair of shoes, for new drapes, for a new home, for a new automobile, for a new business. And we work and we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we strive. And the day that sucker becomes ours, nobody can take it away from us. My God, what a great feeling that is. You know, when I was a kid growing up, hardly anybody owned their own home. Just a very, very few of the elite owned their own home. And once in a while, somebody would scrape enough money together to make a down payment on a little old bitty house. And they would pay, and they would pay, and they would pay, and they would pay. And the day they got that sucker paid off, they threw a party. They called in all the neighbors. And we celebrated by burning the mortgage. What a great feeling that actually was. The only thing wrong with it, though, is just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get that sucker paid for than you look around, well, hell, her house is bigger than mine. Yeah, this guy's in a Brooks Brothers suit, and I bought mine at Kmart's. He's driving a Cadillac, and I'm still in a Chevrolet. And that caused us to set a new goal. And we work, and we work, and we strive, and we strive, and we reach the goal. It feels great, a good feeling, but it doesn't last very long, and we set another goal. It seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more and more and more and more of these things. They're not giving them to us fast enough. We're not getting them the way we think we ought to. So what do we do about that? Well, we take shortcuts. We lie. We cheat. We con. We manipulate. We steal. The instant we do those things, we create pain and suffering for other people. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. The last thing he talks about is the sex instinct.
Better get you a drink of water on that.
Better have me a drink of water before I start.
He gets excited when he starts talking about this.
He said all human beings are born with a desire for sex. Now, it may get turned off by bad teachings or by bad happenings, but he said all human beings are born with a desire to have sex because if we don't have sex, we cannot reproduce ourselves. And if we don't reproduce ourselves, then sooner or later, the human race is going to fail to survive. Now, if you're going to reproduce yourself through the sexual act, it's just like the other two instincts, you're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex than you'll do all day digging a ditch. Don't you older guys remember how it used to be when you got through with it? My God, you fell over sideways. The sweat's just pouring off of you. You can hardly get your breath. You feel like you've died, gone to heaven, and come back two or three times. And I don't think we would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. The great reward we get is at the moment of successful completion of the sex act, we get one of those feelings, both mentally and physically, which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. Never been anything like it before, probably never be anything like it in the future. But also, just exactly like those other two things, it's just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. And it's such a pleasurable and such an exciting thing. The next thing you know, we get to thinking about doing it with different people. We get to thinking about doing it in different ways. We get to thinking about doing it in different positions. And the next thing you know, we're doing it at the wrong time with the wrong people in the wrong way. The instant we do that, we create pain and suffering for others. Plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Because when we hurt others through the sexual act, they're going to retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. So these three basic instincts of life that really determines the things that we do are God-given, they're absolutely necessary for the survival of the human race. The only problem is all human beings have them. All human beings have self-will. All human beings will overdo at one time or another in these three basic instincts of life, one way or another, and all human beings will be thrown in collision with the world and everybody in it. Bill tells us in the 12 and 12 that every emotional problem a human being can have will stem from one of these three basic instincts of life. He said, because of those things, running on self-will, we absolutely cannot keep from harming other people. Now, if we could all fulfill these three basic instincts at the level that God intended, then there would be no conflict in the world today. Everybody would be in perfect peace and harmony with each other. Now, if you'll notice, coming out of those three basic instincts of life, a little circle called self. That's what makes up self-will, those basic instincts of life, trying to fulfill those things. Coming out of self, you'll notice another little circle called wrongs. It's another word you have to look at. Somewhere in AA, we got the idea that wrongs was a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. But if you go to the dictionary and look it up, you'll find several definitions for it. One definition of the word wrong is feelings of bitter hurt or indignation, which comes from rightly or wrongly held feelings of being injured or offended by other people. And that's exactly what a resentment is. Unjustified opinions and feelings of other people. Another definition of the word wrong is fear. You know, every alcoholic that I know is absolutely filled with fear. Fear we're going to lose what we got, fear we're not going to get what we want, fear what other people think of us, and etc. Another definition of the word wrong is the harms and the hurts that we do to other people because of these basic instincts of life. You know, we're not bums. We have a conscience. And the fear of what they're going to do when they catch us, the guilt and remorse associated with those things, absolutely eat us up. It's very, very easy to spot a selfish, self-centered human being. They will always display three common manifestations of self. A selfish, self-centered human being is always madder than hell. Damn her and damn them, and by God they'll not do me that way, and I'll show them and I'll get even with those SOBs. A selfish, self-centered human being is always scared to death. Afraid we're going to lose what we got. Afraid we're not going to get what we want. Afraid what other people think of us, and etc. A selfish, self-centered human being is always doing things based on self that creates harms and hurts for other human beings. Now, a mind that is filled with resentment, a mind that is filled with fear, a mind that is filled with guilt and remorse does not feel good. And we'll run around under those conditions just long enough. And the mind wanting to feel better, and the mind begins to think about that thing that's always made us feel better, that great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we con ourselves into believing we can drink, and we go back and we take the drink, and that triggers the allergy, and we end up drunk and sick all over again. So evidently, if I want the necessary peace of mind, serenity, and happiness for a good future life, I'm going to have to start trying to do something about self-will, get on God's will, and on God's will, then I'm no longer in conflict with other people, places, and things. I'm no longer filled with resentment, fear, and guilt, and remorse, and I might be able to stay sober, Joe.
Okay, so we see that the first requirement is that we be convinced in any life our own self-will could hardly be a success. And then Bill goes into some explanations. He tells us why it won't work. He told us earlier how it works. Now he tells us why it won't work because of selfishness and self-centeredness. He gives us some illustrations here while we try to make people mind and they won't mind. And on page 62, he gives us some more information as to why it won't work. And it said selfishness. Selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self which later put us in a position to be hurt.
Would you repeat that last sentence, please?
Alcoholism, I, self, and me. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based upon the satisfaction of these basic instincts of life that Charlie just talked about, which later put us in a position to be hurt. I want what I want when I want it. Seems to be the rallying cry for most of us alcoholics. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And God makes that possible. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. We've got to have God's help. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help.
One of the greatest mistakes we see people making in AA today is we try to make ourselves better. We try to overcome self with self. We absolutely cannot do that. The only thing that's powerful enough to overcome self is the power that made it in the first place, which is God as we understand it. There seems to be no way of entirely getting rid of self left on our own resources. As Joe is fond of saying, a sick mind cannot heal a sick mind. This power is going to have to come from some source other than our own minds.
I had a friend of mine used to always say, getting self can't get rid of self. No, no. It's like a monkey trying to get rid of bubble gum. It sticks to his hand. Okay. All people have, he talks about it, all people have this. We're not freaks. And we'd like, every human being has self will. It's a God-given thing, so therefore it's good. All people have problems with it. But he's real careful to say, we alcoholics have a self-will run riot.
Extreme example.
We got a bad case of it.
That might be an understatement.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah. So I suppose we think of basically they arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of a self-will run riot. He doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. Now he tells us down here how only way we know to get rid of self. Now, if you're having a problem, obviously, with self-will, okay, then the only thing that could correct self-will would be God's will. That's the only other will that exists. You can't take it to the wheel shop down in the corner. Selling Robux in places like that. God made it. God is the only one to correct a force like this. And it's a powerful force. We have a powerful force within us. No human can control it. It causes all human problems. Only God can control a force like that. The next we decided here after the drama life, God was going to be our director.
First he said, yeah, this is the how and why of it.
Yeah.
First of all, we had to quit playing God. Yeah,
okay.
You know, everything I read makes me believe that this is a God-directed world.
Right.
And those of us who have been self-directed, those of us who have been trying to direct everything and everybody around us, we've been trying to do God's work for Him.
Playing God.
We're not God.
Playing.
We just bit... playing at being God. We're going to have to quit doing it because it does not work. It's obvious, especially for we alcoholics that have tried to control everything and everybody our entire lifetime. The situation got worse and worse and worse and worse by trying to play God, by trying to direct everything and everybody, including ourselves. We just got sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. It did not work.
God was going to be our director. That is a word he changed, not suggestion, but director.
He got his word right back in now.
Put it right back in. He put directive, put direction right back. It made him take it out, but he put it right back. He is the principal. We are his agent. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple. But this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed freedom. Now he's looking at back to his design, the little picture he painted when he said step one was a foundation. Willingness was the foundation. Step one is willingness. Believing was the cornerstone. Now he's telling us we're going to build an arch through which we passed to freedom. We're building an arch. And step three is the keystone of this arch. Now, the keystone is the stone in the very top that holds all the other stones together. So he's telling us step three is the supporting stone of these steps we're taking. And it gives us a little picture as we go along of the progress we were making. So we're building an arch, a spiritual experience, which we're going to pass through to freedom from alcohol.
And we like to emphasize that we don't have to wait till step 12 to start getting something out of this. This wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're building, this personality change sufficient to bring out recovery from alcoholism, is already beginning to take place. Now, we didn't get much out of step 1. We didn't get much out of step 2. Those were just information steps, conclusions of the mind. But now then, as we begin into step 3, we begin to get some results. The personality now begins to change. Joe, page 63.
I love this part of the book, and it says that he is the principal, we're the agents. He's the father, we're the children. Most good ideas are simple, and I almost missed that because I use God like you would an errand boy. God, please get me sober. God, please get my wife back. God, help me make some more money. You go out and do all them things, you know, use him like an errand boy. And after I got sober around for a while, I got to reading another big, big book. And in front of that book, he said that he worked for 6 days and then he rested. To my knowledge, he'd never go back to work anymore. It looks to me like there's going to be any work being done around here. It's going to be me. He's the father. We're the children. He's the boss. I work for him. Most good ideas are simple, and I almost miss that.
Now listen very carefully now.
So now we're on top of page 63. When we sincerely took such a position, the one he just described, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. I thought he was going to do my work well. I had to do his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. See, I've always been a taker. I want to see what I can contribute. Takers are losers, not only in AA, but everywhere. I want to see what I can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And I tell you, that idea about being reborn used to make me just, a hair on the back of my neck would stand up when people talk about it. There was a little church up the road from where I lived, and on Monday night they used to come over to my house and knock on the door and want to talk to me about being reborn. And I'm sitting there drinking, getting ready to watch Monday night football. And man, I'd run those people out of there. Get out of here. Get out of here. I don't even want to talk to you about this stuff. You see, and then and Joe helped me with this years later. He told me the story about Nicodemus. And Nicodemus was just like me, dumber than a rock. Because he went to this guy who was talking about being reborn, and he said, "What do you mean by that? I don't understand. Do you mean I've got to go back into my mother's womb and be reborn?" And I can just see him shaking his head. And he said, "Nicodemus, didn't you go to the university? Aren't you educated? Don't you know you can't do that? When I talk to you about being reborn, I'm talking about the renewing of your mind. Old ideas cast aside, and new ones accepted."
Personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism.
Now I could understand this. See, I could go for that. And so I know I wanted to turn my will and my life over the care of God at that little church. I don't know why I did that, but I did. It's just what I did. And I went down there on Sunday morning, and I knew what they did on Sunday morning about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. They're still doing it. And I went down there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. Didn't want to get there too early. I might hear something that would help me, you see. So I got there, and sure enough, they asked people to come down there and basically to do the third step prayer. That's what they were asking me to do. So I went down there, and the book says we were now at step 3. Now we're ready to do business. It said, "Many of us said to our makers, we understood him. Got off myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I might better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always." And I was sincere and honest and humble as I have ever been in all of my life. I wanted this prayer to happen in my life. I pray this prayer today every time I think about it, because I truly want God's will to be done in my life. Now, I don't know what happened that Sunday morning way back then, but I do know this. Looking from then until today, my life hasn't been the same. I have been reborn. I am not what I used to be, thank God. Well, I'm very, very lucky, because you would not have liked me a long time ago, because I was not a very nice person, and I hurt a lot of people, physically and mentally and emotionally in a lot of ways. Went to prison for some of that. So thank God I'm not what I used to be. I am been reborn, not in my body, but in my mind. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which used to be the guiding force of my life, are gone, and a whole new set of motives begin to dominate me from that moment to this.
We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I think utterly means completely, wholeheartedly, the whole ball of wax. I hope you don't make the mistake I did the first time I took step three. I got down on my knees, which I very seldom did in those days. I said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so on, so on, so forth. And as I finished it up, I said, now this applies to my alcohol. Don't fool with my sex life. And I believe I can handle the money too.
God probably said, what an order, I can't go through with it.
I said, you take the alcohol and I'll take care of the rest. And today I realize the complete fallacy, and that is that God don't want the alcohol.
Yeah.
For as I know, God probably doesn't even drink. What he wants me is me, all of me, period. Now just think, if God could direct my thinking in all areas, not only would I be able to live without alcohol, but my sex life might get better too. My economic life might get better also. Well, I might get better in all areas if God directs my entire thinking. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. It's long been known that prayer, taken in the company of other human beings, has a deeper and a more lasting effect than prayer taken alone. The book's going to refer to it later on, and we are tridimensional creatures. We're meant to live with God, ourselves, and other human beings. And we're praying in company with another human being. We're beginning to fit ourselves back as God intended for us to be in the first place. You know, way back in the beginning in Dr. Bob's house, when it came time for the new alcoholic to make the surrender, they took this new person upstairs into one of the bedrooms. Four or five of them got together and got on their knees. And this new person made their surrender our decision today. And after he had made his decision, made his surrender, the older members would vote on how well he did it. And if he didn't do it good enough, they'd make him do it again later on. They always took it in the company of other human beings. Now I'm going to ask you to do a favor for me. Just a favor for me personally. If you don't want to do this, you don't have to. But what I'd like for you to do is reach out and hold hands with the people on each side of you. It's only going to take us a minute. And I'd like for you to repeat after me. God, I offer myself to thee.
God, I offer myself to thee.
To build with me and do with me as thou wilt.
To build with me and do with me as thou wilt.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
That I may better do thy will.
That I may better do thy will.
Take away my difficulties.
Take away my difficulties.
That victory over them may bear witness.
That victory over them may bear witness.
To those I would help of thy power.
To those that I would help of thy power.
Thy love.
Thy love.
And thy way of life.
And thy way of life.
May I do thy will always.
May I do thy will always.
You'll never have to worry about whether you've taken step three or not. You just did it. Thank you all for being here. See you later.
Joe, and Charlie.
Hi again, my name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
All right, Charlie. Thank you, Glenn.
You all having a good time?
Yeah.
Are you enjoying the big book study?
Yeah.
The 12 and 12?
Yeah.
A little history about the big book and Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't it great?
Yeah.
We're going to start off with a little joke again this time. We're going to get real serious after a while, so we better get the humor started now. And I'm going to tell a little story about an alcoholic, an Al-Anon, and an Alateen. By the way, do we have any Al-Anons in here? Could I see your hands?
Right here.
Yeah, we got some. Okay. All right. This alcoholic, the Al-Anon, the Alateen had been to an AA convention. On the way home, they decided they would go back a different route. take a route through the country so they'd be able to see a little of the countryside on the way back. And they got way out in the country, and sure enough, they got lost. And they tried and tried and tried to find their way out, and finally gave up. Went to the old farmer's house, knocked on the door. Farmer came to the door. They told him what the situation was and asked for directions. He said, well, it's pretty easy for you to get out of here. It's not all that difficult. But he said, I'll tell you what, it's getting so close to dark. You're probably going to get lost again, even if I give you directions. He said, why don't you guys just spend the night here with us? You can get up in the morning and go home, and you won't have any trouble. And they said, oh, well, great, that would be fine. So they all go in the house, and they're sitting around talking, and the farmer said, now, we've only really got one problem. He said, I can only sleep two of you here in the house. One of you will need to go down in the barn and sleep with the animals. The little Alateen said, oh, that's great, let me go down there. He said, I love animals and they love me and I won't have any trouble down there at all. So they all went to bed with the Alateen down in the barn. In about an hour, knock on the front door. Farmer goes to the door and there stands the Alateen. He said, man, I can't sleep down there. He said, the pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking, and I just can't sleep. The alcoholic said, okay, come on inside and go to bed. I'll go down in the barn. I'll sleep with the animals. I was raised on a farm. That'll be no problem for me. So they all go to bed with the alcoholic down in the barn. In about an hour, knock on the front door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the alcoholic. He said, man, I can't sleep down there either. He said, the pigs are grunting, the cows are mooing, the horses are stomping their feet, and the chickens are clucking. I just can't sleep. The Al-Anon said, well, all right. Said, come on in. I knew it would be up to me to handle the situation. He said, you guys go to bed, and I'll go down to the barn, and I'll sleep with the animals. So they all went to bed with the Al-Anon down in the barn with the animals, and sure enough, in about an hour, knock on the door. Farmer goes to the door, and there stands the pigs and the cows and the chickens. Every time I tell that, my wife Barbara really gets upset when I tell that. Okay, we've done a lot of work in the big book up to this point. We've been able to see what our problem is. We've been able to see what the solution is. We've been able to make a decision regarding that solution. And we've actually taken steps 1, 2, and 3. Now, no great big changes have happened through these 3 steps because there's not a whole lot of action involved in them. Step 1 was just a conclusion of the mind. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our life's unmanageable. Step 2 is a conclusion of the mind. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3 is but a decision. And the only action involved in step 3 is when we did the step 3 prayer together. But we've now got 1, 2, and 3 behind us. And now we're ready to get on with the rest of the program. So let's go to the bottom.
Page 63.
And let's start looking at the program of action. Joe?
See, the first word is next. So he tells us what to do next. Right after 3, we do this next. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision,
step 3,
was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And remember again, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was to enable me to find a power greater than myself which would solve my problem. And we're going to start looking at those things which has been blocking us off from the decision that we just made.
So the first thing we like to look at is the time element between step 3 and step 4. And you hear this question asked throughout AA all over the world. How long should you wait to do step four after you have taken step three? And we hear all kind of answers. Some people say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 30 days. Some others say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 90 days. Others may say, well, you probably ought to wait at least 6 months. We heard a professional in the field counseling people to wait a minimum of 2 years. And our question to that counselor was, how many people have you killed with that statement? You see, what we're trying to do is find a way to live. Where not only can we be sober, but we can be peaceful and happy and free at the same time, so that we can have good long-term sobriety. And every day that we put off on step four is another day we remain restless, irritable, and discontented. Another day we stay filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And sooner or later, under those conditions, our mind in seeking relief will begin to think about that great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we become insane, and we end up thinking we can drink, and we end up drunk all over again. I really don't know how long I could go between step three and step four before I ended up drunk, and frankly, I'm not very interested in finding out. The Big Book tells us when we should take step four. It says step three is going to have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And I think when he said at once, he meant right now. So we believe that the Big Book is telling us we should get on with step four just as soon as we finish up with step three. And that does make sense, doesn't it? For as I know, four is always followed exactly after step three. And if we don't do that, after a while, our mind is going to begin to say, well, we really don't need to take step four. Or fear is going to keep us from taking step four. And then sooner or later, we say, to hell with it. And we end up getting drunk all over again. So we believe we ought to go into step four as soon as we finish up with step three. Now, why don't we do that? Knowing full well that we might get drunk if we don't do that, then why would we continue to procrastinate on step four? I think probably two or three reasons. Number one, I think many of the old-timers tend to play king off of the mountain with the newcomer when it comes to step four. And we tell him how hard it is. By God, you just wait till you get to step four. Yada, 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 yada. And we just literally scare them to death with it. Let us be the first to say today, tonight, if we do step four the way the Big Book says to do it, there is absolutely nothing to be afraid of. And I think in a little while we're going to be able to see that. Another reason I think we tend to procrastinate on step four is for years we didn't understand how to do it. Not understanding how Bill writes, not understanding how he likes to use examples of something we already know to teach us something new. We saw him do that when he talked about the great ocean liner, the moment after rescue from shipwreck. He knew that he could use that example and people would understand what he was trying to teach us. Not understanding that Bill did not like to use the same words over and over. And he always found a different word when he wanted to repeat himself. Not understanding those things, we simply could not understand how to do step four according to the Big Book. The instructions are here. They're on page 64. But they are so short and so sweet that we simply overlooked them and didn't understand how to do it. So therefore, we went into step five. And we saw something that said something about sharing all your life story. And we said, oh, That's what they wanted us to do in step four, was write our life story. And that's the way many of us did it way back in the beginning. Now, I don't know whether my life story was very important to other people, but it must have been to me, because when I wrote it, I had 92 pages in it. I took it to another poor, suffering alcoholic, and he read it, and when he got through with it, he said, "That's not very pretty, is it?" And I said, "No, it isn't." He said, "You'll never have to be that way again." And he threw it in the waste paper basket, and I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism by the writing of my life story. As I look back at it tonight, I fully realize 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism anyhow. The fact that I was born in 1929, I don't think it's got a thing to do with my alcoholism. It may have had something to do with somebody else's alcoholism, but not mine. The fact that I graduated from high school at age 17 went immediately into the service. I don't think that had a thing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married at age 21, I don't think that's had a thing to do with my alcoholism. But I tell you what it did. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did have something to do with it, and I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism from the writing of my life story. So in our desperation, somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota, wrote a four-step inventory guide. And we took the Minnesota guide and we combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. Somebody in Dallas, Texas wrote a four-step inventory guide. We took the Dallas guide, we combined it with the Minneapolis guide, we combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. I have no idea how many inventory guides are floating around out there today. We saw one time that had 20 pages in it. And I'll guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be before you were through with this one. It was one of those kinds. And all the time, the instructions had been right here on page 64. And we just couldn't see them. But finally, when we realized how Bill writes, the things that he does, the rhythm of his writing, we began to understand what he wanted us to do. So tonight, let's just kind of relax and take it easy. We'll look at a few words and a few instructions, and I think we're going to be able to see that step four, not only is there nothing to be afraid of, but it is also a very simple procedure if we do it according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, Joe.
Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke.
Now, this is his first comparison, comparing between a business inventory and our personal inventory. You know, if you had a business and you didn't inventory in there once in a while, you wouldn't have any idea where you stand. And I don't care what the business is, whether it's selling ladies' purses, men's watches, bicycles, or whatever. If you didn't inventory once in a while, and by the way, an inventory is defined as a written list of items. And if you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been sold out of your store. And after a while, you would end up with empty shelves and empty floor spaces with nothing to sell. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been stolen that you didn't get paid for. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become out of style. Nobody really wants to buy it. You need to put it on sale so you can get rid of it. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable. Nobody wants to buy it. It's sitting there in your store taking up very valuable shelf space, very valuable floor space. You probably pay an interest on borrowed money to put it in there in the first place. And if you didn't inventory once in a while, eventually you would go broke. I think all of us could probably agree with that statement. Now his first comparison is this. In our lives, we have a business also. And our business in our lives is the business of being able to find a way where we can live peaceful, happy, and free, and be able to stay sober in the future. And if we don't inventory in our personal business and find the out-of-style, damaged, and unsaleable goods and get rid of them, then probably we're going to go broke too. And going broke for us is simply to go back to drinking. So whether we're dealing with a business inventory or a personal inventory, in either case, without it, we're going to go broke.
We got to flip the button.
We got to flip the button.